Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. For almost half a century, the Yiddish theater was the predominant cultural expression of Jews in America. But with the demise of Yiddish as a commonly spoken language, many of the plays and songs have also faded into obscurity.
But this Saturday evening at the Helen Bader Concert Hall in UWM's Zelazo Center, Yiddish theater will be very much alive and well. Song of Second Avenue, Yiddish theater's enduring musical legacy, will feature one of the leading scholars and modern-day performers of klezmer music. Hank Kosnetsky is the founder and director of the Klezmer Conservatory Band based at the New England Conservatory of Music, and he joined Lake Effect's Bonnie North and explained what klezmer is all about.
Klezmer is one of the main kinds of strands of music that developed in the world of Eastern European Jews, a large number of whom came to America in the late 19th, early 20th century. And that's a world that included what they call Hasidic music, which is kind of a very exciting religiously inspired music, chazanis or cantorial music, Yiddish folk song, and all of those worlds came together in the Yiddish theater. So the Yiddish theater really was a catch-all. It didn't start till the late 19th century, and it really flourished, especially in America. And the Yiddish theater used all of those musics as basically, you know, the way to get to the American audience. So the way to get to the immigrant audience. At the immigrant audience, in fact, you know, they would cry, for example. You know, they wouldn't necessarily cry just when a song was sad. It had to kind of sound like the plaintive music of the synagogue. And then they would cry. If you had a wedding, you couldn't just have American wedding music. You had to have klezmorim. You had to have the Jewish wedding music. So that's really how it worked. And so the Yiddish theater was really the place where all of these kinds of music that were the folk musics of that community came together in theater.
I tend to think of the Yiddish theater in America, particularly on the Lower East Side, that that's where it kind of had its heyday in the United States. Is that true, or were there other pockets in the United States where it happened?
Well, there were a lot of different pockets, but in fact, Second Avenue in New York on the Lower East Side is definitely considered the kind of hometown or the Broadway of the Yiddish theater. The thing is that New York was tough. You know, New York was tough. So a composer, for example, might want to be writing for the Yiddish theater in New York, but there were composers who really controlled everything. So they would exile the other composers to places like Philadelphia or Minneapolis, and those people would have to do Yiddish theater in their towns. And then sometimes the shows would go to New York. But there was a lot of competition among the immigrants. And there were Yiddish theaters in these other places, so it wasn't all in New York. But one thing about New York that was very important was that New York was also a place where jazz was really becoming a big thing in the 1920s and 1930s, and that influenced the Yiddish theater, especially the Yiddish theater that was growing in New York.
Did it also influence Tin Pan Alley?
Oh, yes. Yiddish theater, you could say, there's a couple ways that it influenced Tin Pan Alley. I mean, the main way it was that if a Yiddish theater tune became really popular among the Jews, then people would say, well, why not among everyone else? And the biggest example of that happened in 1938 when a Yiddish theater song called Bimir Bis Dushain became the number one song in America. And in fact, the biggest hit that the country had ever known in a recording by the Andrews Sisters. And in the time after that, in the 4 or 5 years after that, between that time and, say, the recording ban that came into effect during the Second World War, there were so many popular songs written in Tin Pan Alley that had this reference point that either were directly translated Yiddish theater songs or novelty songs that came out from artists like Cab Calloway and Slim Gaylord. It was kind of, you know, it just kind of became one of the main popular trends at that time.
Spiel
The original Yiddish theater, of course, was for a Jewish audience who spoke Yiddish. It was done in Yiddish. How much did they care about the non-Yiddish speaking, the non-Jewish audience? Were they looking ahead and saying, you know, hey, it works here, let's try it out there?
I don't think they were doing that at all. I think they really were thinking that their audience was the Jewish immigrant audience, and that was enough, you know. I mean, there were 3 million Jews in New York by the turn of the century. There were something like, you know, 100,000 in Philadelphia. So already there were these huge immigrant populations, and they wanted entertainment. And if they had looked for a larger audience, they would have translated things. But that didn't really happen much. I mean, as the Yiddish kind of slipped away, for example, by the 1920s, there were people who didn't speak so much Yiddish. What they would do is they'd work some English into the songs and just throw a few English words in, and then, you know, that would keep the children happy. But that was about it. Really, these shows were done in Yiddish. There were no compromises of that type, and the sheet music was all in Yiddish, and no translations. And, you know, probably the first translated Yiddish theater songbook, I think, came out in the 1960s.
That late? Wow.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course, Yiddish, I don't think of it as a dead language, but it's certainly not spoken as much now, or is that not true? Is it having a resurgence?
Yeah, it's having a resurgence, definitely having a resurgence among academics, and that's one of the reasons for this conference. I mean, the concert is part of a conference that's taking place at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, organized by Joel Berkowitz, who's a professor there, and he has written extensively about the Yiddish theater, and he himself has translated Yiddish theater plays and really just doing incredible work to get the message of the Yiddish theater out there, because there's no parallel literature. That literature of that community is simply in Yiddish. If you don't know Yiddish, you have no access to about 60 or 70 years of Jewish thought and feelings. Ihr sucht du ganz trotz dein Wissen, als Jod ein anderer Mensch bei mir gemacht. Die hast auf ihn reingeworfen in er Gerät, die hast sich der den ganzen mir jetzt meine Gemüt.
You were talking about how the music was part of that and how that expressed Jewishness in America. And in your studies, from the musical part of it, how did the music shift, and how are we looking at it today? Is it music that is alive, or is it more academic and, you know, more museum-like?
It's all over the map, you know. I mean, part of it is that my generation cannot look at this as nostalgia, because we didn't grow up with it, so we're not really looking back. We're discovering it for the first time. And I'm talking about my generation. I mean, I'm 60, so, I mean, this has been going on for quite a while. The generation for whom it was nostalgia is, you know, those who are alive, or at least, you know, in their 80s or 90s at this point. So it's really interesting, because what we do is we discover songs that we feel have something to say to us. And that can be from a lot of different points of view. Actually, from my point of view, I mean, I'm an instrumentalist. I'm an improviser. I play piano and saxophone and a lot of woodwinds. So I'm looking for tunes. I'm looking for melodies. And I have found for myself an entire repertoire of music from the Yiddish theater that is parallel to the Great American Songbook, and that is almost completely unknown. And when I play these songs, I can really express not only, you know, my identity as a jazz musician, but also my identity as a Jewish musician. So I find that incredibly rewarding. But for other people, it could just be the message of the song. I mean, it's funny, we're doing a song, actually, which was a huge hit in the early 1920s, called Yenta Telebenda. And a yenta, Well, you know yenta.
I know what a yenta is, but the rest of it I don't know.
Well, yeah. Yenta telebenda, you can imagine what the rest of it is. It's like a super yenta. So it's someone who basically just tells everybody exactly what she thinks all the time. So Miriam Chaya Siegel, you know, I sent her this song thinking, okay, she's either going to love it or she's going to hate it. And she goes, I love it. You know, I'm going to give it this feminist spin, you know, that you know, women in those days who maybe they were making fun of the fact that these women were pushy, but in fact, this woman is a hero. You know, this is a liberated woman of the 1920s. So, I mean, it's that kind of thing. It's like basically to take these songs and just see how, you know, not only how much fun they are, but how they express feelings that people have now, but they just didn't know there was this repertoire. It's just like the Great American Songbook in that way, but it's Jewish, you know. So it's really got this compounded feeling. I mean, one of the best performers of this music is a guy named Shane Baker, who's not from a Jewish background. He's just a great New York cabaret performer, and he almost exclusively uses music from the Yiddish theater because he just feels like it's more direct, it's more honest, it's less glitzy, and it really says what people are really thinking.
And he sings it in Yiddish.
Anything's in Yiddish.
That's fantastic. I've always thought Yiddish was such an expressive language.
Well, it is. It's got a unique kind of feeling to it that in many ways is very, you know, very direct, kind of cuts to the chase. It's not so polite, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it was the language that the parents would speak and not teach to the kids because they wanted the kids to be polite. They wanted the kids to be Americans. They wanted the kids to seem like everyone else. Meanwhile, the parents are having the time of their lives speaking the secret language that is, you know, sarcastic and you know, has a take on everything, has a proverb about everything. It's extremely rich, and that's what we find. I mean, it's funny. I there's a swing song here that we're doing called, you know, Prost und Pushit, you know, Prost und Pushit, Chob Dich Lieb. And it's like, you can say, I love you. But if you say Prost und Pushit, Chob Dich Lieb, you're saying, plain and simple, I love you. You know, I mean, it's that kind of language, you know, it's got a worldview to it that cannot really be replaced.
And it obviously bleeds over into the music as well. The same attitude is in the music.
Exactly. The music is also unique, and the music has an attitude, too. It's music that kind of says, like, oi, you know? It's like, it might be lively, but at the same time, it's always got a little bit of, like, you know, irony to it.
Which is what, again, makes it all so delicious.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, the thing is that for so many years, and I mean, for me, I remember as a teenager, I wanted to learn this music. The pathway into it was so difficult because it was dying out. It had really been repressed very much in the Jewish community as, you know, something that was vulgar, something that, you know, the younger generation just wouldn't be interested in. And it had been replaced, of course, by also, you know, in education, by everything modern, everything contemporary that was all about building Israel. So for us, we didn't grow up with Yiddish. We didn't grow up very much with these kinds of songs. And at the same time, from the moment I heard them, and I heard them from when I was very young because my family were musicians, I immediately said, what's that? I want to learn that. And then they would say, nah, don't bother. It's dying out. And, you know, finally, I took this envelope of sheet music that I think I found in my closet when I was 15 or 16. I took it out, and I started looking at it. I started asking for help and started studying Yiddish to try to decipher it. But it's amazing how even in this day and age, there's not one book on popular Yiddish theater music after 1924. Everything goes up to 1924, and then it's as if nothing happened. Well, there's, you know, another 30, 40 years of great Yiddish theater music after that. So it's incredible. I mean, the academic world has totally ignored it. The Jewish education world has totally ignored it. And meanwhile, you know, those of us who do it find that the audiences can't get enough.
Hank Osnetsky's Hebrew National Salvage will perform this Saturday evening at UWM's Zelazo Center. The program is called Song of Second Avenue, Yiddish Theater's Enduring Musical Legacy, and is presented by the Sam and Helen Stahl Center for Jewish Studies at UWM. There are links to more information from WUWM.com.